The portly man looked at him, mouth tucked in and trembling slightly. Then he returned to the other men, whose views no doubt more closely corresponded to his own. Henry turned back to the Winnebago and resumed waiting for Underhill to come out. He had an idea that Underhill was his only hope, but whatever Underhill's doubts about this operation might be, the hope was a thin one, and Henry had only one card to play. The card was Jonesy. They didn't know about Jonesy. The question was whether or not he should tell Underhill. Henry was terribly afraid that telling the man would do no good. About 5 minutes after Mr. Middle Management followed the stretcher-bearers into the Bago, the three of them came out again, this time with a fourth on the stretcher. Under the brilliant overhead lights, the wounded man's face was so pale it looked purple. Henry was relieved to see that it wasn't Underhill, because Underhill was different from the rest of these maniacs. 10 minutes passed. Underhill still hadn't come out of the command post. Henry waited in the thickening snow. There were soldiers watching the inmates. That's what they were, inmates, and it was best not to gild the lily, and eventually one of them strolled over. The men who had been stationed at the T-junction of the Deep Cut and Swanee Pond roads had pretty well blinded Henry with their lights, and he didn't recognize this man by his face. Henry was both delighted and deeply unsettled to realize that minds also had features, every bit as distinctive as a pretty mouth, a broken nose, or a crooked eye. This was one of the guys who had been out there, the one who had hit him in the ass with the stock of his rifle when he decided Henry wasn't moving toward the truck fast enough. Whatever had happened to Henry's mind was skitsy. He couldn't pick out this guy's name, but he knew that the man's brother's name was Frankie, and that in high school, Frankie had been tried and acquitted on a rape charge. There was more as well, unconnected jumbles of stuff like the contents of a wastebasket. Henry realized that he was looking at an actual river of consciousness, and at the flotsam and jetsam the river was carrying along. The humbling thing was how prosaic most of it was. "Hey there," the soldier said amiably enough. "It's the smartass." "On a hot dog, smartass?" He laughed. "Already got one," Henry said, smiling himself. And Beaver popped up out of his mouth, as Beaver had a way of doing. "Fuck off, Freddy." The soldier stopped laughing. "Let's see how smart your ass is 12 hours from now," he said. The image that went floating by, borne on the river between this man's ears, was of a truck filled with bodies, white limbs all tangled together. "You growing the Ripley yet, smartass?" Henry thought, the virus. That's what he means. The virus is what it's really called. Jonesy knows. Henry didn't reply, and the soldier started away, wearing the comfortable look of a man who has won on points. Curious, Henry summoned all his concentration and visualized a rifle. Jonesy's Garand, as a matter of fact. He thought, "I have a gun. I'm going to kill you with it the second you turn your back on me, asshole." The soldier swung around again, the comfortable look going the way of the grin and the laughter. What replaced it was a look of doubt and suspicion. "What'd you say, smartass? You say something? Just wondering if you got your share of that girl. You know, the one Frankie broke in? Did he give you sloppy seconds?" For a moment, the soldier's face was idiotic with surprise. Then it filled in with black Italian rage. He raised his rifle. To Henry, its muzzle looked like a smile. He unzipped his jacket and held it open in the thickening snow. "Go on," he said and laughed. "Go on, Rambo, do your thing." Frankie's brother held the gun on Henry a moment longer, and then Henry felt the man's rage pass. It had been close. He had seen the soldier trying to think of what he would say, some plausible story, but he had taken a moment too long, and his forebrain had pulled the red beast back to heel. It was all so familiar. The Richie Grenadoes never died, not really. They were the world's dragon's teeth. "Tomorrow," the soldier said. "Tomorrow's time enough for you, smartass." This time Henry let him go. No more teasing the red beast, although God knew it would have been easy enough. He had learned something, too, or confirmed what he'd already suspected. The soldier had heard his thought, but not clearly. If he'd heard it clearly, he would have turned around a lot faster. Nor had he asked Henry how Henry knew about his brother Frankie, because on some level, the soldier knew what Henry did. They had been infected with telepathy, the whole walking bunch of them. They had caught it like an annoying, low-grade virus. "Only I got it worse," he said, zipping his jacket back up again. So had Pete, and Beaver, and Jonesy. But Pete and the Beav were both dead now, and Jonesy got it worst of all, Henry said. And where was Jonesy now? South. Jonesy had hooked back south. These guys' precious quarantine had been breached. Henry guessed they had foreseen that that might happen. It didn't worry them. They thought one or two breaches wouldn't matter. Henry thought they were wrong. Owen stood with a mug of coffee in his hand, waiting until the guys from the infirmary were gone with their burden. Melrose's sobs mercifully reduced to mutters and moans by a shot of morphine. Pearlie followed them out, and then Owen was alone with Kurtz. Kurtz sat in his rocker, looking up at Owen Underhill, with curious, head-cocked amusement. The raving crazy man was gone again, put away like a Halloween mask.
"I'm thinking of a number," Kurtz said. "What is it?"
17, Owen said. "You see it in red, like on the side of a fire engine." Kurtz nodded, pleased.
"You try sending one to me."
Owen visualized a speed limit sign. 60 miles per hour.
6, Kurtz said after a moment. "Black on white."
"Close enough, boss." Kurtz drank some coffee. His was in a mug with "I love my grandpa" printed on the side. Owen sipped with honest pleasure. It was a dirty night and a dirty job, and Freddy's coffee wasn't bad. Kurtz had found time to put on his coverall. Now he reached into the inner pocket and brought out a large bandana. He regarded it for a moment, then got to his knees with a grimace. It was no secret that the old man had arthritis, and began to wipe up the splatters of Melrose's blood. Owen, who thought himself surely unshockable at this point, was shocked.
"Sir."
"Oh, fuck."
"Boss."
"Stow it," Kurtz said without looking up. He moved from spot to spot, as assiduous as any washerwoman.
"My father always said you should clean up your own messes. Might make you stop and think a little bit the next time. What was my father's name, Buck?"
Owen looked for it and caught just a glimpse, like a glimpse of slip under a woman's dress.
"Paul?" "Patrick, actually. But close. Anderson believes it's a wave, and it's expending its force now. A telepathic wave. Do you find that an awesome concept, Owen?"
"Yes."
Kurtz nodded without looking up, wiping and cleaning.
"More awesome in concept than in fact, however. Do you also find that?"
Owen laughed. The old man had lost none of his capacity to surprise. Not playing with a full deck, people sometimes said of unstable individuals. The trouble with Kurtz, Owen reckoned, was that he was playing with more than a full deck. A few extra aces in there. Also a few extra deuces, and everyone knew that juices were wild.
"Sit down, Owen. Drink your coffee on your ass like a normal person, and let me do this. I need to."
Owen thought maybe he did. He sat down and drank the coffee. 5 minutes passed in this fashion, then Kurtz got painfully back to his feet. Holding the bandana fastidiously by one corner, he carried it to the kitchen, dropped it into the trash, and returned to his rocker. He took a sip of his coffee, grimaced, and put it aside.
"Cold."
Owen rose.
"I'll get you a fresh..."
"No, sit down. We need to talk."
Owen sat.
"We had a little confrontation out there at the ship, you and I, didn't we?"
"I wouldn't say..."
"No, I know you wouldn't. But I know what went on, and so do you. When the situation's hot, tempers also get hot. But we're past that now. We have to be past it. Because I'm the OIC, and you're my second, and we've still got this job to finish. Can we work together to do that?"
"Yes, sir."
Fuck, there it was again. "Boss, I mean. Kurtz favored him with a wintry smile.
I lost control just now. Charming, frank, open-eyed and honest. This had fooled Owen for a lot of years. It did not fool him now. I was going along, drawing the usual caricature, two parts Patton, one part Rasputin, add water, stir and serve, and I just, whew, I just lost it. You think I'm crazy, don't you?
Careful, careful. There was telepathy in this room, honest to God telepathy, and Owen had no idea how deeply Kurtz might be able to see into him.
Yes, sir. A little, sir.
Kurtz nodded matter-of-factly.
Yes, a little.
That pretty well describes it.
I've been doing this for a long time. Men like me are necessary but hard to find, and you have to be a little crazy to do the job and not just high-side it completely. It's a thin line, that famous thin line the armchair psychologists love to talk about, and never in the history of the world has there been a clean-up job like this one. Assuming, that is, the story of Hercules neatening up the Aegean stables is just a myth. I'm not asking for your sympathy, but for your understanding. If we understand each other, we'll get through this, the hardest job we've ever had, all right. If we don't, Kurtz shrugged. If we don't, I'll have to get through it without you. Are you following me?
Owen doubted if he was, but he saw where Kurtz wanted him to go and nodded. He had read that there was a certain kind of bird that lived in the crocodile's mouth at the croc's sufferance. He supposed that now he must be that kind of bird. Kurtz wanted him to believe he was forgiven for putting the alien broadcast on the common channel, heat of the moment, just as Kurtz had blown off Melrose's foot in the heat of the moment. And what had happened 6 years ago in Bosnia? Not a factor now. Maybe it was true. And maybe the crocodile had tired of the bird's tiresome pecking and was preparing to close its jaws. Owen got no sense of the truth from Kurtz's mind, and either way, it behooved him to be very careful. Careful and ready to fly. Kurtz reached into his coverall again and brought out a tarnished pocket watch.
This was my grandfather's, and it works just fine, he said. Because it winds up, I think. No electricity. My wristwatch, on the other hand, is still foobar.
Mine too.
Kurtz's lips twitched in a smile.
See Perlmutter when you have a chance and feel you have the stomach for him. Among his many other chores and activities, he found time to take delivery of 300 wind-up Timexes this afternoon, just before the snow shut down our air ops, this was.
Pearlie's damned efficient. I just wish to Christ he'd get over the idea that he's living in a movie.
He may have made strides in that direction tonight, boss.
Perhaps he has at that. Kurtz meditated. Underhill waited.
Laddie Buck, we should be drinking the whiskey. It's a bit of an Irish death watch we're having tonight.
Is it?
Aye, me beloved Pooka is about to keel over dead.
Owen raised his eyebrows.
Yes, at which point its magical cloak of invisibility will be whisked away. Then it will become just another dead horse for folks to beat, primarily politicians who are best at that sort of thing.
I don't follow you. Kurtz took another look at the tarnished pocket watch, which he'd probably picked up in a pawn shop or looted off a corpse. Underhill wouldn't have doubted either.
It's 7 o'clock. In just about 40 hours, the president is going to speak before the UN General Assembly. More people are going to see and hear that speech than any previous speech in the history of the human race. It's going to be part of the biggest story in the history of the human race, and the biggest spin job since God the Father Almighty created the cosmos and sent the planets going round and round with the tip of his finger.
What's the spin?
It's a beautiful tale, Owen. Like the best lies, it incorporates large swatches of the truth. The president will tell a fascinated world, a world hanging on every word with its breath caught in its throat, praise Jesus, that a ship crewed by beings from another world crashed in northern Maine on either November 6th or November 7th of this year. That's true. He will say that we were not completely surprised, as we and the heads of the other countries which constitute the UN Security Council have known for at least 10 years that E.T. has been scoping us out. Also true. Only some of us here in America have known about our pals from the void since the late 1940s. We also know that Russian fighters destroyed a Grey Boy ship over Siberia in 1974, although to this day the Ruskies don't know we know. That one was probably a drone, a test shot. There have been a lot of those. The Greys have handled their early contacts with a care which strongly suggests that we scare them quite a lot. Owen listened with a sick fascination he hoped it didn't show on his face or at the top level of his thoughts where Kurtz might still have access. From his inner pocket, Kurtz now brought out a dented box of Marlboro cigarettes. He offered the pack to Owen, who first shook his head, then took one of the remaining 4 fags. Kurtz took another, then lit them up.
"I'm getting the truth and the spin mixed in together," Kurtz said after he'd taken a deep drag and exhaled. "That may not be the most profitable way to get on. Let's stick to the spin, shall we?"
Owen said nothing. He smoked rarely these days, and the first drag made him feel lightheaded, but the taste was wonderful.
"The president will say that the United States government quarantined the crash site and the area around it for 3 reasons. The first was purely logistical. Because of the Jefferson Tract's remote location and low population, we could quarantine it. If the Grey Boys had come down in Brooklyn or even on Long Island, that would not have been the case. The second reason is that we are not clear on the aliens' intentions. The third reason, and ultimately the most persuasive, is that the aliens carry with them an infectious substance which the on-scene personnel calls Ripley fungus. While the alien visitors have assured us passionately that they are not infectious, they have brought a highly infectious substance with them. The president will also tell a horrified world that the fungus may in fact be the controlling intelligence. The Grey Boy is just a growth medium. He will show videotape of a Grey Boy literally exploding into the Ripley fungus. The footage has been slightly doctored to improve visibility, but is basically true.
You're lying, Owen thought. The footage is entirely fake from beginning to end, as fake as that alien autopsy shit. And why are you lying? Because you can. It's as simple as that, isn't it? Because to you, a lie comes more naturally than the truth.
Okay, I'm lying, Kurtz said, never missing a beat.
He gave Owen a quick, gleaming look before dropping his gaze to his cigarette again.
But the facts are true and verifiable. Some of them do explode and turn into red dandelion fluff. The fluff is Ripley. You inhale enough of it, and in a period of time we can't yet predict, it could be an hour or 2 days, your lungs and brain are Ripley salad. You look like a walking patch of poison sumac, and then you die. There will be no mention of our little venture earlier today. According to the president's version, the ship, which had apparently been badly damaged in the crash, was either blown up by its crew or blew up on its own. All the Grey Boys were killed. The Ripley, after some initial spread, is also dying, apparently because it does very poorly in the cold. The Russians corroborate that, by the way. There's been a fairly large kill-off of animals, which also carry the infection. And the human population of Jefferson Tract? POTUS is going to say that about 300 people, 70 or so locals, and about 230 hunters are currently being monitored for the Ripley fungus. He will say that while some appear to have been infected, they also appear to be beating the infection with the help of such standard antibiotics as Ceftin and Augmentin. And now this word from our sponsor, Owen said. Kurtz laughed, delighted. At a later time, it's going to be announced that the Ripley seems a little more antibiotic resistant than was first believed, and the number of patients have died. The names we give out will be those of people who have in fact already died, either as a result of the Ripley or those gruesome fucking implants. Do you know what the men are calling the implants?
Yeah, shit weasels. Will the president mention them?
No way. The guys in charge believe the shit weasels are just a little too upsetting for John Q. Public. As would be, of course, the facts concerning our solution to the problem here at Goslin's store, that rustic beauty spot.
The final solution, you could call it, Owen said. He had smoked his cigarette all the way down to the filter, and now crushed it out on the rim of his empty coffee cup. Kurtz's eyes rose to Owen's and met them unflinchingly.
Yes, you could call it that. We're going to wipe out approximately 350 people. Mostly men, there's that, but I can't say the cleansing won't include at least a few women and children. The upside, of course, is that we will be ensuring the human race against a pandemic and, very possibly, subjugation. Not an inconsiderable upside.
Owens thought, but I'm sure Hitler would like the spin, was unstoppable. But he covered it as well as he could and got no sense that Kurtz had heard it or sensed it. Impossible to tell for sure, of course. Kurtz was sly.
How many are we holding now? Kurtz asked.
About 70, and twice that number on the way from Kineo. They'll be here around 9 if the weather doesn't get any worse.
It was supposed to, but not until after midnight.
Kurtz was nodding.
Uh-huh. Plus, I'm going to say 50 more from up north, 70 or so from St. Cap's and those little places down south. And our guys, don't forget them. The masks seem to work, but we've already picked up 4 cases at Ripley in the medical debriefings. The men, of course, don't know.
Don't they?
Let me rephrase that, Kurtz said. Based on their behavior, I have no reason to believe the men know. All right?
Owen shrugged.
The story, Kurtz resumed, will be that the detainees are being flown to a top-secret medical installation, a kind of Area 51, where they will undergo further examination and, if necessary, long-term treatment. There will never be another official statement concerning them, not if all goes according to plan, but there will be time-release leaks over the next 2 years, encroaching infection despite best medical efforts to stop it, madness, grotesque physical changes better left undescribed, and finally, death comes as a mercy. Far from being outraged, the public will be relieved. While in reality, he wanted to hear Kurtz say it, but he should have known better. There were no bugs here, except maybe for the ones hiding between Kurtz's ears, but the boss's caution was ingrained. He raised one hand, made a gun of his thumb and forefinger, and dropped his thumb 3 times. His eyes never left Owen's as he did this. Crocodile's eyes, Owen thought.
All of them? Owen asked. The ones who aren't showing Ripley positive as well as those who are? And where does that leave us, the soldiers who also show negative?
The laddies who are okay now are going to stay okay, Kurtz said. Those showing Ripley were all careless. One of them, well, there's a little girl out there, about 4 years old, cute as the devil. You almost expect her to start tap dancing across the barn floor and singing On the Good Ship Lollipop.
Kurtz obviously thought he was being witty, and Owen supposed that in a way he was, but Owen himself was overcome by a wave of intense horror. There's a 4-year-old out there, he thought. Just 4 years old. How about that?
She's cute, and she's hot, Kurtz was saying. Visible Ripley on the inside of one wrist, growing at her hairline, growing in the corner of one eye. Classic spots. Anyway, this soldier gave her a candy bar, just like she was some starving Kosovar rug muncher, and she gave him a kiss. Sweet as pie, a real Kodak moment, only now he's got a lipstick print that ain't lipstick growing on his cheek.
Kurtz grimaced.
He had himself a little tiny shaving cut, barely visible, but there goes your ball game. Similar stuff with the others. The rules don't change, Owen. Carelessness gets you killed. You may go along lucky for a while, but in the end, it never fails. Carelessness gets you killed. Most of our guys, I'm delighted to say, will walk away from this.
We're going to face scheduled medical exams for the rest of our lives, not to mention the occasional surprise exam, but look at the upside. They're going to catch your ass cancer wicked early.
The civilians who appear clean, what about them? Kurtz leaned forward, now at his most charming, his most persuasively sane.
You were supposed to be flattered by this, to feel yourself one of the fortunate few to see Kurtz with his mask, two parts Patton, one part Rasputin, add water, stir, and serve, laid aside. It had worked on Owen before, but not now. Rasputin wasn't the mask. This was the mask. Yet even now, here was the hell of it. He wasn't completely sure.
Owen, use your brain. That good brain God gave you. We can monitor our own without raising suspicions or opening the door to a worldwide panic. And there's going to be enough panic anyway after our narrowly elected president slays the Puka horse. We couldn't do that with 300 civilians. And if we really flew them out to New Mexico, put them up in some model village for 50 or 70 years at the taxpayers' expense, what if one or more of them escaped? Or what if, and I think this is what the smart boys are really afraid of, given time, the Ripley mutates. That instead of dying off, it turns into something a lot more infectious and a lot less vulnerable to the environmental factors that are killing it here in Maine. If the Ripley's intelligent, it's dangerous. Even if it isn't, what if it serves the gray boys as a kind of beacon? An interstellar road flare marking our world out. Yum, yum, come and get it. These guys are tasty. There's plenty of them.
You're saying better safe than sorry. Kurtz leaned back in his chair and beamed. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. Well, Owen thought, it might be the nut, but the shell is something we're not talking about. We watch out for our own. We're merciless if we have to be, but even Kurtz watches out for his laddie bucks. Civilians, on the other hand, are just civilians. If you need to burn them, they go up pretty easy.
If you doubt there's a God, and that he spends at least some of his time looking out for good old Homo sape, you might look at the way we're coming out of this, Kurtz said. The flashlights arrived early and were reported. One of the reports came from the store owner, Reginald Goslin himself. Then the gray boys arrive at the only time of year when there are actually people in these godforsaken woods, and two of them saw the ship go down. That was lucky. God's grace is what it was. Their ship crashes, their presence is known, the cold kills both them and the galactic dandruff they brought along.
He ticked the points off rapidly on his long fingers, his white eyelashes blinking.
But that's not all. They do some implants, and the goddamn things don't work. Far from establishing a harmonious relationship with their hosts, they turn cannibal and kill them. The animal kill-off went well. We've censused something like 100,000 critters, and there's already one hell of a barbecue going on over by the Castle County line. In the spring or summer, we would have needed to worry about bugs carrying the Ripley out of the zone, but not now. Not in November.
Some animals must have gotten through.
Animals and people both, likely. But the Ripley spread slowly. We're going to be all right on this because we netted the vast majority of infected hosts, because the ship has been destroyed, and because what they brought us smolders rather than blazes. We've sent them a simple message. Come in peace, or come with your ray guns blazing, but don't try it this way again because it doesn't work. We don't think they will come again, or at least not for a while. They played fiddly-fuck for half a century before getting this far. Our only regret is that we didn't secure the ship for the science boffins. But it might have been too Ripley infected anyway. Do you know what our great fear has been? That either the Gray Boys or the Ripley would find a Typhoid Mary. Someone who could carry it and spread it without catching it him or herself.
Are you sure there isn't such a person?
Almost sure. If there is, well, that's what the cordon's for.
Kurtz smiled.
We lucked out, soldier. The odds are against the Typhoid Mary. The Gray Boys are dead,
and all the Ripley is confined to the Jefferson Tract. Luck or God. Take your choice.
Kurtz lowered his head and pinched the bridge of his nose high up like a man suffering a sinus infection. When he looked up again, his eyes were swimming. Crocodile tears, Owen thought, but in truth he wasn't sure. And he had no access to Kurtz's mind. Either the telepathic wave had receded too far for that, or Kurtz had found a way to slam the door. Yet, when Kurtz spoke again, Owen was almost positive he was hearing the real Kurtz, a human being, and not Tick-Tock the Croc.
"This is it for me, Owen. Once this job is finished, I'm going to punch my time. There'll be work here for another 4 days, I guess. Maybe a week if this storm's as bad as they say. And it'll be nasty. But the real nightmare's tomorrow morning. I can hold up my end, I guess. But after that, well, I'm eligible for full retirement, and I'm going to give them their choice, pay me or kill me. I think they'll pay because I know where too many of the bodies are buried. That's a lesson I learned from J. Edgar Hoover. But I've almost reached the point of not caring. This won't be the worst one I've ever been involved in. In Haiti, we did 800 in a single hour. 1989, that was, and I still dream about it. But this is worse. By far. Because those poor schmucks out there in the barn and the paddock and the corral, they're Americans. Folks who drive Chevys. Shop at Kmart and never miss ER. The thought of shooting Americans. Massacring Americans. That turns my stomach. I'll do it. Only because it needs to be done in order to bring closure to this business. And because most of them would die anyway. And much more horribly. Capiche?
Owen Underhill said nothing. He thought he was keeping his face properly expressionless, but anything he said would likely give away his sinking horror. He had known this was coming, but to actually hear it. In his mind's eye, he saw the soldiers drifting toward the fence through the snow, heard the loudspeakers summoning the detainees in the barn. He had never been part of an operation like this. He'd missed Haiti, but he knew how it was supposed to go. How it would go. Kurtz was watching him closely.
I won't say all is forgiven for that foolish stunt you pulled this afternoon, that water's under the bridge, but you owe me $1. I don't need ESP to know how you feel about what I'm telling you, and I'm not going to waste my breath telling you to grow up and face reality. All I can tell you is that I need you. You have to help me. This one time.
The swimming eyes, the infirm twitch, barely perceptible at the corner of his mouth. It was easy to forget that Kurtz had blown a man's foot off not 10 minutes ago. Owen thought, if I help him do this, it doesn't matter if I actually pull a trigger or not. I'm as damned as the men who herded the Jews into the showers at Bergen-Belsen.
If we start at 11, we can be done at 11:30, Kurtz said. Noon at the very worst.
Then it's behind us.
Except for the dreams.
Yes. Except for them.
Will you help me, Owen?
Owen nodded. Yet he had come this far and wouldn't let go of the rope now, damned or not. At the very least, he could help make it merciful as any mass murder could be. Later, he would be struck by the lethal absurdity of this idea. But when you were with Kurtz, up close, and with his eyes holding yours, perspective was a joke. His madness was probably much more infectious than the Ripley in the end.
Good. Kurtz slumped back in his rocker, looking relieved and drained. He took out his cigarettes again, peered in, then held the pack out.
Two left. Join me?
Owen shook his head.
Not this time, boss.
Then get on out of here.
If necessary, shag ass over to the infirmary and get some Sonata.
I don't think I'll need that, Owen said. He would, of course. He needed it already, but he wouldn't take it. Better to lie awake.
All right, then. Off you go.
Kurtz let him get as far as the door.
And Owen?
Owen turned back, zipping his parka. He could hear the wind out there now, building, starting to blow seriously as it had not during the relatively harmless Alberta Clipper that had come through that morning.
Thanks,
Kurtz said. One large and absurd tear overspilled his left eye and ran down his cheek. Kurtz seemed unaware. In that moment, Owen loved and pitied him, in spite of everything, which included knowing better.
Thank you, Buck.
Henry stood in the thickening snow, turned away from the worst of the wind and looking over his left shoulder at the Winnebago, waiting for Underhill to come back out. He was alone now. The storm had driven the rest of them back into the barn, where there was a heater. Rumors would already be growing tall in the warmth, Henry supposed. Better the rumors than the truth that was right in front of them. He scratched at his leg, realized what he was doing, and looked around, turning in a complete circle. No prisoners, no guards. Even in the thickening snow, the compound was almost as bright as noonday, and he could see well in every direction. For the time being, at least, he was alone. Henry rebent and untied the shirt knotted around the place where the turn signal stalk had cut his skin. He then spread the slit in his blue jeans. The men who had taken him into custody had made this same examination in the back of the truck where they had already stored five other refugees. On the way back to Goslin's, they had picked up three more. At that point, he had been clean. He wasn't clean now. A delicate thread of red lace grew down the scabbed center of the wound. If he hadn't known what he was looking for, he might have mistaken it for a fresh seep of blood. Virus, he thought.
Ah, fuck, good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
A flash of light winked at the top of his vision. Henry straightened and saw Underhill just pulling the door of the Winnebago shut. Quickly, Henry retied the shirt around the hole in his jeans and then approached the fence. A voice in his head asked what he'd do if he called to Underhill and the man just kept on going. That voice also wanted to know if Henry really intended to give Jonesy up. He watched Underhill trudge toward him in the glare of the security lights, his head bent against the snow and the intensifying wind. The door closed. Kurtz sat looking at it, smoking and slowly rocking. How much of his pitch had Owen bought? Owen was bright. Owen was a survivor. Owen was not without idealism, and Kurtz thought Owen had bought it all, with hardly a single dicker. Because in the end, most people believed what they wanted to believe. John Dillinger had also been a survivor, the wiliest of the 30s desperados, but he had gone to the Biograph Theater with Anna Sage just the same. Manhattan melodrama had been the show, and when it was over, the feds had shot Dillinger down in the alley beside the theater like the dog he was. Anna Sage had also believed what she wanted to believe, but they deported her ass back to Poland just the same. No one was going to leave Goslin's market tomorrow except for his picked cadre, the 12 men and 2 women who made up Imperial Valley. Owen Underhill would not be among them, although he could have been. Until Owen had put the Grey Boys on the common channel, Kurtz had been sure he would be. But things changed. So Buddha had said, and on that one at least the old chink heathen had spoken true. "You let me down, Buck," Kurtz said. He had lowered his mask to smoke, and it bobbed against his grizzled throat as he spoke. "You let me down." Kurtz had let Owen Underhill get away with letting him down once, but twice? Never. Kurtz said. Never in life. Chapter 14. Going South. Mr. Gray ran the snowmobile down into a ravine which held a small frozen creek. He drove north along this for the remaining mile to I-95. 200 or 300 yards from the lights of the army vehicles, there were only a few now moving slowly in the thickening snow, he stopped long enough to consult the part of Jonesy's mind that it, could get at. There were files and files of stuff that wouldn't fit into Jonesy's little office stronghold, and Mr. Gray found what he was looking for easily enough. There was no switch to turn off the Arctic Cat's headlight. Mr. Gray swung Jonesy's legs off the snowmobile, looked for a rock, picked it up with Jonesy's right hand, and smashed the headlight dark. Then he remounted,
and drove on. The cat's fuel was almost gone, but that was all right. The vehicle had served its purpose. The pipe which carried the creek beneath the turnpike was big enough for the snowmobile, but not for the snowmobile and its rider. Mr. Gray dismounted again. Standing beside the snowmobile, he revved the throttle and sent the machine bumping and yawing into the pipe. It went no more than 10 feet before stopping, but that was far enough to keep it from being seen from the air if the snow lightened, allowing low-level recon. Mr. Gray set Jonesy to climbing up the turnpike embankment. He stopped just shy of the guardrails and lay down on his back. Here he was temporarily protected from the worst of the wind. The climb had released a last little cache of endorphins, and Jonesy felt his kidnapper sampling them, enjoying them the way Jonesy himself might have enjoyed a cocktail or a hot drink after watching a football game on a brisk October afternoon. He realized, with no surprise, that he hated Mr. Gray. Then Mr. Gray, as an entity, something that could actually be hated, was gone again, replaced by the cloud Jonesy had first experienced back in the cabin when the creature's head had exploded. It was going out as it had gone out in search of Emil Brodsky. It had needed Dog Brodsky because the information about how to get the snowmobile started hadn't been in Jonesy's files. Now it needed something else. A ride was the logical assumption. And what was left here? What was left guarding the office where the last shred of Jonesy cowered? Jonesy, who had been turned out of his own body like lint out of a pocket. The cloud, of course. The stuff Jonesy had breathed in. Stuff that should have killed him, but had, for some reason, not done so. The cloud couldn't think, not the way Mr. Gray could. The man of the house, who was now Mr. Gray instead of Mr. Jones, had departed, leaving the place under the control of the thermostats, the refrigerator, the stove, and, in case of trouble, the smoke detector and the burglar alarm, which automatically dialed the police. Still, with Mr. Gray gone, he might be able to get out of the office. Not to regain control. If he tried that, the red-black cloud would report him and Mr. Gray would return from his scouting expedition at once. Jonesy would almost certainly be seized before he could retreat to the safety of the Tracker Brothers' office, with its bulletin board and its dusty floor and its one dirt-crusted window in the world. Only there were 4 crescent-shaped clean patches in that dirt, weren't there? Patches where 4 boys had once leaned their foreheads, hoping to see the picture that was pinned to the bulletin board now. Tina Jean Schlossinger, with her skirt up. No, seizing control was far beyond his ability, and he'd better accept that, bitter as it was. But he might be able to get to his files. Was there any reason to risk it? Any advantage? There might be, if he knew what Mr. Gray wanted. Beyond a ride, that was, and speaking of that, a ride where? The answer was unexpected, because it came in Duddits's voice.
Ow! Eerie, on the wow!
South. Mr. Gray, wanna go south. Jonesy stepped back from his dirty window on the world. There wasn't much to be seen out there just now anyway, snow and dark and shadowy trees. This morning's snow had been the appetizer. Here was the main course. Mr. Gray, wanna go south. How far? And why? What was the big picture? On these subjects, Duddits was silent. Jonesy turned and was surprised to see that the route map and the picture of the girl were no longer on the bulletin board. Where they had been were 4 color snapshots of 4 boys. Each had the same background, Derry Junior High, and the same caption beneath, School Days, 1978. Jonesy himself on the far left, face split in a trusting ear-to-ear grin that now broke his heart. Beeve next to him, the Beeve's grin revealing the missing tooth in front, victim of a skating fall which had been replaced by a false one a year or so later, before high school anyway. Pete, with his broad, olive-tinted face and his shamefully short hair, mandated by his father who said he hadn't fought in Korea so his kid could look like a hippie. And Henry, on the end. Henry in his thick glasses that made Jonesy think of Danny Dunn, boy detective, star of the mysteries Jonesy had read as a kid. Beaver, Pete, Henry. How he had loved them, and how unfairly sudden the severing of their long friendship had been. No, it wasn't a bit fair.